This is Pretty Much Pop, a culture podcast, stoning you and saying good luck. Today we're discussing the phenomenon of early Bob Dylan as depicted in the James Mangold film A Complete Unknown, starring Timothée Chalamet. I'm Mark Lintzemeyer, the voice of some generation yet to be born.
I'm the freewheeling Al Baker.
I'm Sarah Lynn Brock, and in my prime, I used to dress so fine, threw bumps, dimes. Didn't you guys do that?
My name is Lawrence Ware, coming to you right now from Stillwater, Oklahoma. And you can call me Mr. Tambourine Man, and I will play a song for you.
Nice.
Well, let's all try not to do that.
you guys set it up. You guys said, listen, I am a novice here. I'm doing the best I can.
Let's briefly review. And we've done, there have been a number of music topics on this podcast over the years, often in the wilderness years, in the season two, when I didn't have steady hosts, I would just get a bunch of musicians. So the Beatles episode, it was like, who do I know that's a super Beatles fan? Let's gather them all in here. When we did Taylor Swift, which was with the old host, we at least got a Swiftie, one person who was a super fan. We did the Beyonce, which Lawrence already had a lot of priors in. Here, we're going in with, I think, Al. You are our special guest. This is central for your musical development. Is that right?
Welcome, Al. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's great to be here. I've been engaging with a lot of Bob Dylan again recently, and it's just left me with this inflated sense of mystique and ego for reasons we can probably go into. But yeah, Bob Dylan was probably my first major musical obsession that was really worth it. You know, I had musical obsessions before that maybe didn't stand the test of time, but I absolutely adored him, emulated him, and still do think in some ways that he's the greatest artist maybe of the 20th century. He's a really incredible figure. I kind of fell out with him in my late 20s because he does have this really, really palpable sense of condescension around almost everything he does. And I kind of fell out with that aspect of his music and embraced people who I thought were more egalitarian, I guess, in their tone. But then revisiting him for this podcast has really reminded me why I revered him so much in the first place. I don't know if any of you guys have ever seen him live. It's a profoundly curious experience that's really more akin to a kind of religious ceremony than anything else. And that really kind of pinpoints the unique place that Dylan has in musical culture. He is really, like, in some ways by his own design, a quasi-human prophet, an object of reverence, and really not to be understood by mere mortals.
Wow.
And that is something that I think the new movie, which is what we're also going to talk about today, really did a fantastic job of capturing, that really strange position that Dylan occupies as a scion of authenticity in a country movement, but who simultaneously positions himself as a deified prophet kind of figure.
Wow.
Wow.
Big word salad to start with. Sorry. I was supposed to just say, yeah, I liked him a lot when I was a teenager.
I mean, you teed that up.
Can I give a counterpoint?
Yeah.
So first of all, I like Bob Dylan now. And through this experience, I became more fond of the earlier stuff, which was, I didn't really discover him significantly until I had just graduated from college, and the person that I was trying to date was this huge Dylan fan. And so I went through I'm going to listen to every single, and she like sent me a mix. And so the stuff that I liked was the sort of more romantic stuff, was the Sad Eyed Lady, the Lowlands, was the Blood on the Tracks era, If Not For You, some of the lighter stuff. Not what had struck me before, what had made him not really stick to me was that I don't think protest songs generally age well. I think this movie did a really good job of like making it come alive and like being in that moment and seeing why audiences might be so into the times they are changing. But for me, it already just came sort of pre-hackneyed and didn't seem authentic to me. And what I heard from other people was, why does his voice sound so funny? Well, because he was doing a Woody Guthrie impression, that there was nothing actually, he was not a beacon of authenticity. He was actually pretty full of shit and used this mystique to sort of get by. Again, I appreciate his artistry and the presentation in this movie of just a young guy who is like a good craftsman and stumbled on a zeitgeist. Wouldn't doubt that he lit up a room, but you know, my dad was a folky of the time, and he was very much of the Weavers, Pete Seeger. This guy does not have a good voice. End of story. Which then I learned in listening to the Chronicles, this time around how Dylan loved Harry Belafonte. Dylan played his first session as a harmonica player on a Harry Belafonte record, something that is not in the movie. So these divisions between sort of old folk and new, you know, it's way time for us to get past that. Anyway, so I do think he's immortal, amortal. The fact that he's still around is a gift to us. That's almost the same with any elderly artist like this, but it just seems like there is no reason why this human being should still be with us on the earth, occasionally producing something according to his whims and getting out as often as he does.
Not after all those cigarettes.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, he did smoke a lot.
Thank the Lord he was around long enough to make his Christmas album.
It's funny, Bob Dylan is just one of those figures that's been around for all of our lives. You know, he's as kind of omnipresent as like Brooke Shields or something. Like, he's just always there, you know? And I never fell into a Bob Dylan kind of obsession like you, Al, did, or even Mark. My dad, though, he was just a couple years younger than Bob Dylan. And when he was in high school, he used to just put on his records and study them. I didn't even realize this, but I think my dad was really inspired as a musician by him. And my dad was just, you know, he just played like the guitar and the banjo and the fiddle and stuff like for fun. But I think he was musically inspired by this guy. And I learned probably more about my dad and his love of Bob Dylan than I did about Bob Dylan himself, which kind of ties into the movie, I think, pretty effectively, because I think we're sort of learning about this guy through all of the people who were kind of in his orbit. I don't know. What was your experience with this, Lawrence?
Okay. Are you asking my experience with the film or my experience with Bob Dylan? Because those are two completely separate things.
To start with the latter, but yeah, then get us into the film. Yeah.
Okay. So I thought I had no relationship with Bob Dylan, honestly. I genuinely didn't. I thought he was a weird sounding guy who I was not very struck by. And then I started going through his catalog. Thank you, Al. Al put together a wonderful, I don't know if he put it together.
Yeah, thank you.
Or he just already had it, but he put together a wonderful.
No, handcrafted.
I would recommend you like maybe put that out publicly so people can listen to that if they want to.
Yeah, rename it in a nicer way and then make it public and we'll link to it. Yeah.
But once I got into Bob Dylan's songs, I then begin to realize I actually do have a relationship with Bob Dylan, but only through covers, right? So, for example, Jimi Hendrix, one of my very favorite songs, is Along with the Watchtower. I had no idea. I never did a deep dive into that song. Had no idea that that was originally a Bob Dylan song. Another song, just like Tom Thumb's Blues, I think the name of the song is. Mm. Nina Simone did a wonderful cover of that song. Had no idea that that was a Bob Dylan song. Then there's Sam Cooke's Blowing in the Wind. Had no idea that that was a Bob Dylan song. So here's what I've come to discover. I thought I did not have a relationship with Bob Dylan. I don't think I genuinely have a relationship with the artist and him singing the songs, but I do have a relationship with people covering his song. Like even Adele did a cover of a Bob Dylan song. So that is to say that I really respect Bob Dylan as a songwriter. I think he's a wonderful songwriter. I think he's a unique songwriter. I think he is incredibly talented as a songwriter. Him singing his own songs doesn't do it for me. It's just something about it. It doesn't do it for me. But when other people interpret his songs and kind of make it their own, particularly Black artists kind of bringing that soulful kind of thing to the song, I really, really enjoy it. So I did not have a great relationship with him. You know, I didn't have a father who loved Bob Dylan as Sarah did. I didn't try to date a woman who was a big Bob Dylan fan and then went down the rabbit hole like Mark did. I didn't have those kinds of relationships with him. And I didn't cultivate it before you guys thrust me into listening to him. Listening to his songs, as I said, I don't love him singing his songs, but I do love the craftsmanship of his songs. I do love the way he puts together words. I love the way that he brings in interesting melodies to the song. I think he's a very talented songwriter. I just would prefer to listen to maybe other people sing the songs that he writes. But I think he's very talented. I'm very happy that I did this deep dive. Now, getting into the film, we can get into that a little bit later on, because I think the film is a wonderful film. And I think Timothée Chalamet is absolutely stunning as Bob Dylan. But we can get into that later on. But I did not have a deep relationship with the artist. I'm very happy that I did this deep dive with you guys.
So I think you're sort of uncovering, it's as if we did a George Gershwin or a Burt Bacharach episode or something. These are people that, like, their songs are among us, Irving Berlin, but you might not, like, have any association with who this person is because they're before our time, and I'm sure a lot of our audience is going to feel or would have felt that way about Bob Dylan. Yeah, this is a weird time. I mean, this could be a separate topic perhaps later, like the SNL movie and this. Biopics are nothing new, but to work so hard at, we're going to have, you know, him actually, Chalamet learn, and I think all the musicians learn from the ground up how to play like that. So it's not like he's just moving his hands and then session, absolutely. Professional musicians are in the background doing the actual, you know, in an old time film, it wouldn't have even been him singing at all, let alone playing the guitar and the harmonica and learning that style so exactly. I'm in awe. Does everybody like this movie? Except, you know, I understand if purists being kind of, well, you didn't get this right or this right, or like, I just don't like the whole idea. It's like a weird AI reproduction or something. Like these these attempts to recreate, I wouldn't say a dead person, that young man doesn't exist anymore. So yes, I'm sure you've seen the meme going around of Bob Dylan responding to the film like, well, I'm going to do a biopic of Timothy Chalamet and I'm going to put on a little hat and I'm going to do a silly voice. We'll see how he likes it. Like, well, no, you couldn't even do that of yourself unless you were like Howard Stern in Private Parts where he's like, I'm going to play my 20-year-old self as a 50-year-old or whatever he did. But that was just weird. But yeah, what did we all think of this movie-making attempt?
Certainly, I think Bob Dylan will have been happier with I'm Not There as a biography of him because it's like weird and impenetrable. But A Complete Unknown was, I think, really fantastic. And it almost entirely down to that incredible performance by Timothy Chalamet. Elements of the film I didn't love. I thought it leaned a little bit too much into soppy biopic tone. But the performance that Timothy Chalamet put together, I thought was really incredible for one main reason, which is that he found a way to be a consistent human while embodying the outward behavior of this like deeply weird and barely understandable man. It's like, it's one thing I thought that we've got a recent history of really terrific musical biopic performance, but it's one thing to be Jamie Foxx as Ray Charles or Johnny Cash, Joaquin Phoenix as Johnny Cash, who were big personalities, but there's nothing terribly like mysterious about them. They wore who they were on their sleeves pretty clearly. But Bob Dylan is, I mean, it's the film title, right? He's a mystery as a personality, just weird. Like the things that we know that he's done and said in public are incredibly few and far between, given how famous the guy is. We know very little about what he's got up to over the years. But the things that we do know that he's done and said are weird, disjointed, disconnected, and like barely comprehensible. And for Timothy Chalamet to pull that complete performance out of that character is really, really impressive.
I agree. I also love, I mean, again, all of the people in his orbit, I thought that all of the leads, I thought Edward Norton as Pete Seeger was just incredible. And just to watch his character react to this, he's not an imposter, he's a disruptor, even though I kind of hate that word now, but he is a true disruptor in that space. And it was really, really fun to watch Pete Seeger react to bringing in this new kid into the folk space, watching him write new songs and then reject it, you know, was just, it was kind of equal parts heartbreaking. And also it was like, well, this is what progress is. This is what happens in music, is that it evolves, you know, and that was just fascinating.
It was very Oedipal, wasn't it? It was like he creates yes. this monster.
Exactly.
I put a lot of this film on James Mangold. So if you go into a deep dive on James Mangold, the director, he knows what he's doing. He's had some misses. Like he did the Indiana Jones movie last year that you guys absolutely hated. He did that movie.
I didn't hate it, for the record.
You didn't like it. He did Night and Day. It
wasn't my favorite.
Say what? It wasn't your favorite?
It wasn't favorite? My Moving favorite. But it, anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
Anyway, he did Night and Day in 2010, but he knows what he's doing. So he did Copland. I think a really, really good movie. Heavy is a movie that came out in 1995. If you go back and watch that film, it is seriously good. Girl Interrupt, he did that. Now, his first biopic was Walk the Line. That is an astounding film. That is really, really good. He pulled out of Joaquin Phoenix a wonderful performance. He pulled out of Reese Witherspoon an Oscar-winning performance. She won Best Actress for that film. That was a wonderful film. It was nominated for a number of different kinds of awards. Then he did 310 to Yuma, you know, a Western that I like a great deal. Wolverine, a good movie. Logan, which I would argue is probably one of the best superhero films that has ever been made. It is so incredibly good. Ford vs. Ferrari, an old man's favorite film somewhere, you know, I guarantee. So James Mangold is a really good director. And I think that one, Timothée Chalamet is really talented. He's kind of proven himself to be really, really having an incredible ability to embody a number of different kind of roles. So he's incredibly talented. He's paired with James Mangold. And so what we have here is a biopic that is a biopic. It is certainly a biopic, but it's an interesting take on one, right? And it doesn't do all the beats of what most biopics do. And what's even more interesting is that I doubted that it was even possible to do a biopic about this particular guy. Now, as I said, I didn't know his music, but I knew he was weird. Like, it was clear Bob Dylan is a singular human being. And so to do a biopic about a guy as strange as this and to pull it off, I'm kind of in awe of what they did. And I would not be surprised if it didn't win Oscars, because it is such an incredibly good movie. Timothée Chalamet embodies that character in such an interesting way. While he keeps the weirdness, but he brings the humanity. I really enjoyed the film. I thought it was a wonderful film.
You know, I wonder if they didn't have all of this time. They were kind of stuck in development hell. You know, like, I think Chalamet was given the script like in 2020 or something. And so they had, unintentionally, they had all of this time where Timothée Chalamet learned how to play the guitar. Like, so much they were able to actually zero in on his finger work and stuff on the guitar. Pete Seeger playing the banjo, you know, Edward Norton learned how to play the banjo. They learned how to sing. I mean, for God's sake, Joan Baez, the Monica Barbaro? Anyway, she plays Joan Baez, and she admitted she could not sing, or she didn't think she could sing before it. And she had this time to really not just sing, but she sang in a way that resembles like Joan Baez. Like, holy crap. I just wonder if this would have been a wholly different film if they hadn't had all of this unintentional time on their hands.
Mm-hmm. I don't know that I was fully aware how much – I'm very familiar with the punk revolution in terms of now everybody can be a band. Everybody can do it. But that's how in the early 60s folk music was seen.
Mm-hmm.
So you actually could – nobody's going to like, okay, we're doing a Pavarotti biopic. Hey, random actor, please learn to sing like Pavarotti by, you know, over the next 2 years.
Well, we have Maria now.
You'd have to get a classically trained.
I'm almost certain that she's not singing. She's not doing singing. I'll guarantee you.
I think she did. She did. I think she did sing.
Did she really? Get out of here. Okay. Maybe she did. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Mark.
Just that, you know, this is supposed to be a DIY kind of music and mm-hmm. The banjo, I'm surprised by. I'll say there are finger-picking things that folkies do, some of which I don't yet know how to do. I was just working with YouTube. So, but I understand that it's a sort of a mechanical process, and it's like Mickey Dolenz of the Monkees learning to play the drums for the part. that he was cast as an actor, and they said, you're the drummer. And like, oh, okay, I guess I got to learn drums. And like, yes, eventually he was playing on records and he was playing on a tour and things, but it was not about that. If Hugh Jackman can make his physique into Wolverine, well, then I can believe somebody could learn to play a decent finger-picking guitar lick in the same amount of time. People do extreme things to their bodies.
I just have a delightful mental image, and I hope it really happened, of Timothée Chalamet in his like full Dune get-up sitting in his trailer playing...
I wouldn't doubt
country
it.
Songs.
I genuinely wouldn't doubt if he wasn't in, you know, in this trailer working on things. No, I recently this weekend watched a movie called Facing the Crowd. It's a wonderful movie directed by Eli Kazan. Has Andy Griffith in his first, I think, film role. Anyway, he plays a character who sings and plays a guitar. And the way that they shoot the film, it is clear he is not playing the guitar. Like, he's singing. He's just like, just doing things with his arms that makes no sense. And I really appreciate now they're actually trying to get shots of people actually playing the guitar. Because back in the day, they didn't give a care.
We'll have a stand-in for that. Somebody's hands on the piano keys. We don't need to see their face.
At least they're trying. At least they're trying.
I know. Not just the guitar, but the harmonica, too. He learned how to play the harmonica.
I mean, that's so impressive.
If auto-tune was used, it was not evident. Like, that is just on every movie musical, I expect it to be auto-tuned to shit.
Yes.
And it was something about folk. It was not required.
I go one step further. It seemed to me like every bit of music performed in the movie was live. It seemed like every time someone was playing a guitar and singing, they were doing it in the scene. I could be wrong about that, but
you're right.
That was the impression was incredible.
That's the impression I got as well, yeah.
You're right. Mangold has talked about that, how they were filming it. They were playing live and singing live, kind of like what they did on Wicked. I mean, and he did that again because everybody came in. They were just so good. He was like, we might as well use it.
But the unknown element, right? This is why I was not initially attracted to him as a singer-songwriter, because for me, singer-songwriter thing is about expressing your emotions. And so it's about becoming an open book so I can identify with you, the singer. You're singing to me. You're singing my pain. And Bob Dylan does not allow you to do that. He's doing something else. There are times when he allows you to do that. This is, you know, the stuff that I was saying I was initially more enthralled by because, of course, he's had a lot of years. But this early period of Dylan, this was the hardest for me to get a hold of initially. Clearly, there's some, you know, North Country Girl or, you know, just Ain't No Use in... Ten Wonder Why, Babe, if and you don't know by now, his
Don't Think Twice, It's All
Right. Don't Think Twice, It's All Right, yes. But even that, it's a little oblique.
Yeah, so the obliqueness, I think, is kind of the point in more than one ways. What kind of kept becoming clear to me as I was thinking about the ways I was going to extol the virtues of Bob Dylan on this podcast is that it's difficult because Dylan was revolutionary in so many different ways, and you kind of need to talk about them all. So there's the thing that the movie focused in on, which was his effect on the folk scene and on the music business. So, like, he's writing his own songs, and that's a big deal. He kind of invents the modern singer-songwriter as well as the modern genre of folk music. And he has this really disruptive impact on folk music as a genre. But something that the movie didn't go into all that much, which I think is really behind his exalted legacy as an artist and a lyricist, and the reason that he won the Nobel Prize, which is something we haven't mentioned yet, he's a Nobel Prize winning folk singer, has to do with the obliqueness that you mentioned, Mark, which is his lyricism and the way he uses lyrics, which is really easy to overlook how groundbreaking it was at the time. But what Dylan does that no one else has really done before is write songs as poems, writes lyrics in a poetic style.
Yeah.
The big influence on Dylan that the movie didn't really go into was beat poetry, the literature that was fashionable in the counterculture at the time. Mm-hmm. And the reason something like A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall hit like it did is that nobody had heard lyrics that sounded anything like that before. And yeah, it's oblique, but it's oblique in the way that beat poetry is oblique. It's mm-hmm. evocative and expressive. It's not transparent. It is very opaque. But it's one of the ways that Dylan was revolutionary that has really cemented him as a super important musical figure, because he's the guy who gave singer-songwriters permission to be pretentious, essentially. He's the reason you get songs that sound like poems. Because before that, like, folk music was Pete Seeger and the Seekers. Pop music was crooners and, like, Tin Pan Alley stuff. Blues music was, like, raw and expressive. But what Dylan did was bring literature to the art of songwriting, which is so revolutionary and is really often kind of overlooked.
That's really smart, Al. I was thinking about how inclusive folk music is. You know, so inclusive that they're inviting the audience to sing along. And that was not Bob Dylan's bag. He did not want that.
No, and it's weird. And that is a tension that the movie gets at really, really well, is that mm-hmm. Dylan clearly values, like, the authenticity. There's that brilliant scene of him in the TV studio when he's, like, in the early stages of ruining Pete Seeger's life. And he has the session with the blues singer in the studio. And he clearly, like, loves the fact that this guy is raw and honest and is, like, deeply into the authenticity of blues music. But he does not want to be of the people. He's an artist and he knows he's an artist. And he thinks people should, like, deal with whatever he wants to give them. And it's so interesting because, again, the movie does a really good job of pointing this out. He goes into his career extremely deliberately building himself up to be something that audiences are going to want to look at and like engage with and be impressed by. But he almost immediately then very quickly comes to despise people who are falling for his shtick and, yeah, does not want people singing along, doesn't want people expecting him to play the songs that he wrote in order to be popular.
Yep.
Yeah, he's not a consistent guy.
He's a strange guy.
No, kind of an asshole too.
Well, a lot of people who become good musicians are assholes. Look at Mark. But you know, the thing.
But he was definitely an asshole first.
The thing that I was going to say, you guys completely missed my great joke about Mark, but you guys, it's fine. We'll keep rolling. But nevertheless, I was kind of taken, going into his discography and listening to it, I was taken by how, I don't know if this has been written about, but I got the impression that a lot of hip hop artists were inspired by Bob Dylan. Right? Because the way that he would put together lyrics and songs and all that kind of stuff, it reminded me of like Curtis Blow, for example, or it reminded me of an LL Cool J, like the early, like even a Beastie Boy, like the early hip hop, not today's 21 Savage kind of stuff, not that stuff, but early hip hop, it seemed like what he was doing inspired them in their song construction as well. I was very taken by that. I wouldn't be surprised at all if Bob Dylan wasn't, you know, if there weren't pieces written like in a Rolling Stone or something, because that seems like a place where it would do it. They would talk about Bob Dylan's relationship with hip hop and how hip hop artists are kind of taken by him, because it seems that the way that he was writing songs would be a direct influence on what a lot of these guys were doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could totally see that.
Yeah. And it's interesting, you know, the racial dynamics in the film, this could have been something that was made much more blatant by having that scene with the blues guy that both Pete Seeger and Bob Dylan are admiring and around. It's saying, if it didn't have that scene in there, I would think that folk, mainstream folk, was very white.
Mm-hmm.
And here's a guy who, like, I want to do talking blues. Like, that's this Maggie's Farm song and stuff. Like, this is black music that he is doing. And the folkies, it's less the electricity and the volume and more just like, where did that taint come from? That's not the lily white, pure artistic stuff that we were expecting, the gentle folkiness of Peter, Paul, and Mary. This is something raw that scares us and it challenges our sexuality or something like that. I don't know. What did you think about that? Like, it's something that they didn't feel the need to spell out in that particular way. Because it's not like he had black people in his band, right? He didn't go that far.
Yeah, it feels like a deliberate omission because you can't do everything. And I think you're right. That scene, TV studio, was super important for establishing the relationship to some degree between white folk music and blues music at the time. You can make a whole different movie about the racial politics of the music scene at that time. And I want to say that they could have done more, but I also don't know what they could have. Oh, I do know what they could have cut. There was like the last act dragged a little bit. They maybe could have had a scene or two where people at the Newport Folk Festival were talking to some black people instead of just about some black people. But yeah, I think that's a good point.
I mean, I was thinking that exact same thing, Al, that although I wouldn't go into Bob Dylan because I don't know Bob Dylan that well, but you could make an entire movie about the relationship of these super duper popular white artists, whether they be folk or you can go into the Rolling Stones, you can go into the Beatles, and their relationship with black music, because that is something that people who are like in my circle, who are the scholars, this kind of stuff, we know that stuff, but it's probably not mainstream. Many people probably don't even know that relationship, right? They have no idea the relationship of, for example, British artists, you know, and their relationship with the blues. Like, they have no idea. So I would have liked to have seen more, to be sure. I mean, guys, I'm a professor and the associate director of the Africana Center. So, of course, I would love to see more. But I do think that that scene is important and it's a subtext. I would like for it to be more overt, but I'm happy that it's there because they could have just omitted it. They could have just not included that at all. And so I think them including that is doing something good. I would have liked to see more, though.
Wasn't Dylan, though, didn't he say he wasn't interested in music for a cause? He wasn't interested in singing for civil rights, for example, like with the folk music. What they were interested was in more about being inclusive, bringing people together, and also using it literally in marches for civil rights. And he wasn't, but he was interested, very interested, obviously, in music and admired musicians. It didn't matter to him where it may have come from. But he was very interested in musicians and singers and you know, he was obviously influenced also by the blues as well, but it was always about the music. It wasn't about, at least it seemed from my research on Bob Dylan, it seemed it was more about the music and less about the messaging.
That's somewhat one of the many places where I think he's inconsistent. He was very up for being a part of the like straightforward political scene that was hanging around Greenwich Village around the same time, until it started to overwhelm him and get a bit grating. And then he decides that actually he never wanted to do that in the first place, and it's all a big waste of his time. So the same kind of pattern crops up again and again. Like, he likes doing things that are going to get people's backs up. And then when people start applauding him for doing those things, he decides he wants to do the next thing that's going to get those people's back up.
Mm-hmm. Such a contrarian.
He is a contrarian.
He's such a weird guy. Good Lord.
And not a particularly nice guy, and clearly like not a particularly principled guy. Pete Seeger's the moral backbone of that movie, and Dylan's just like bouncing off the walls.
But yet you love him.
I do love him. And here's something else that's relevant, because just even in the fact of telling a story about Bob Dylan, and maybe here's where we can bring up the previous movie, I'm Not There, which is really odd, because the reason that movie was made was because there was an idea at the time that a film biopic of Bob Dylan would be basically impossible. So now the fact that this movie exists, the more straightforward version, it's kind of a challenge to the reason for I'm Not There existing in the first place. But there's this whole kind of idea of myth-making that's so central to Dylan. They handle it in the movie, especially by talking about the carnival stories, mm-hmm. and like all of the random fictitious stuff that Bob Dylan decided to come up with to make his own legend, because the truth about his upbringing is very depressingly mediocre. His parents owned a hardware store. He was a pretty like solidly middle-class guy. I don't think he actually worked in a carnival. But that is also a huge part of the kind of folksy tradition that he admired. One of my favorite books when I was a teenager was Woody Guthrie's autobiography, which is called Bound for Glory. And is a brilliant...
Now, that I did read.
Brilliant, rip-roaring read. It's an autobiography, right? He's writing it like, these are the things that happened to me, but none of it is real. He's just making up tall tales from beginning to end.
I loved it.
And this is the guy that Dylan is really inspired by, right? Because it's not just Woody Guthrie's music, it's the fact that he knows how to build himself up to be this like folksy, larger-than-life American hero, and that's something that Dylan wants to emulate more than any singular aspect of like musical greatness. So there is something very weird about just even making a movie like this about this person, because the only thing we really know about what Bob Dylan says about himself and his own life is that it's unlikely to be true, because he doesn't seem to feel the need to tell anyone the truth about what he's thinking or feeling.
What did you think of the scene in A Complete Unknown where he's singing The Times They Are Changing to the audience? It's like, oh, this is a new song. And they're eating it up. Every new line, they're just cheering. They've never heard it before. And they're just cheering. Like, this seemed... I know that these movies oversimplify and they... Do you think this was an accurate retelling of exactly how it went to... I've never heard of any new song of any sort being immediately taken up in that way on a line by line basis of people listening to the lyrics, you know. And
I've heard live recordings of exactly those kinds of things going down for Bob Dylan and other folk singers of the time. It's like, you got to think of it like stand-up comedy. So political folk music in the 1960s was where people who defined themselves by their politics went to be validated. Like, people might go to see a stand-up comedian now. So you go and you hear someone say something which expresses a similar political belief as you, and you go wild because you've not heard it expressed that well or that artfully before. So absolutely that happened. I've got a fantastic record by Phil Oakes, who wasn't in the movie, and I was disappointed he wasn't in the movie, but he has a great live concert at Radio City Hall somewhere in New York, and there are multiple times when he's playing brand new songs and there are rounds of applause, huge peals of laughter through the auditorium and rounds of applause after every single line, because everyone's just so enthusiastic about what he's saying and the way he's saying it.
It's like, you know, we mentioned the beat poets at the time. People were going to big poetry readings, you know. I mean, it's almost unheard of today, but people were going to poetry readings and really hanging on every single word. And when Pete Seeger, you know, at the end, at that last concert, was like, they can't hear the words, the music is too loud, that really kind of spoke to, that's what they were looking for. They wanted to hear what these people had to say, even if it was something that they hadn't heard before.
Well, I will say that the one piece of criticism that I ever get when I play recordings of myself for my father is if he can't hear the words well enough, as a person who is a folk singer in that generation.
Mm-hmm.
So I mix the vocals really hot now. Since the 90s, when the 90s you had to swallow it. That was the rule. You brought up I'm Not There. I didn't have a pleasant experience with that movie. I don't know. What did you guys
I didn't enjoy it. Yeah, I didn't very much enjoy it. I appreciated it more than I enjoyed it.
That's a good way of putting it.
It's a good effort. For people who don't know, it's a supposed biopic of Bob Dylan in which Bob Dylan is played by, is it like 7 or 9 different actors? I didn't watch it again for this, but if I recall correctly, the first actor who plays him is a small black boy, which mm-hmm. is an interesting decision. But it's really cool. Like Cate Blanchett, is it Cate Blanchett that does
Blanchett.
A turn? Mm-hmm. And she's fantastic. As
she's
the,
really
like,
good.
Super cool.
She's good at everything she does.
Yeah, bringing it all back home kind of era Bob Dylan. And it was very like chin-strokey and interesting, but also kind of baffling and silly.
It's not a good movie. I mean, it's not a good movie. It's not an enjoyable movie. It's an interesting exercise. I don't know if I'm happy that they did it, though, but it's an interesting exercise. Anyone who's listening to this and it's like, oh, I really enjoyed A Complete Unknown, or there are other Bob Dylan movies I should watch, don't watch that. Like, find something else. Don't watch that because you will not enjoy that.
Why, though? Like, why do you think it's not worthwhile? I mean, I couldn't say that I enjoyed this movie, but I am glad that I watched it before we recorded.
I mean, see, the thing is, we're cinephiles. Like, we're people who will watch a whole bunch of different things and we'll take it in. If a person is not like a hardcore, I need to go deep into the history of this particular subject matter. If you're trying to watch stuff to enjoy it, that's not an enjoyable film. At least it wasn't for me. Maybe Mark really enjoyed it, but it was not enjoyable
no,
for me.
In fact, I feel like I would need to watch it again to like fully get it. Like maybe I wasn't paying attention to enough things. I did watch it, you know, on TV in little bits. And I fell into that like some of the Heath Ledger story, which was basically like mm-hmm, a marriage mm-hmm. story, sort of, mm-hmm. you know, that level of pain of watching it. But at least I found it interesting. Whereas then Richard Gere as Billy the Kid, like, why is this in here? I don't want this to be in here. Please cut back to something else. I don't understand why it's in there. So I would have to watch it again to really understand. Maybe I wasn't paying attention when they introduced the character, blah, blah, blah.
Don't watch it
But I don't want to watch it again. I'm never going to watch
it
again.
Don't watch it again.
So
it's a movie for really hardcore Dylan fans because mm-hmm. that's what this Billy the Kid referenced. That's a movie that explores the Dylan mythos, but you have to come at it from a position of already understanding the Dylan mythos. If you want to understand why Dylan is a beloved and respected and revered figure, then the new movie does a much better job of spelling that out for you.
Yeah, so probably having that pre-knowledge. Actually, I had the Wikipedia page open while I was watching the movie, trying to make these connections because it was not linear. And I was like, I don't understand how these things
are connected.
To be clear,
I don't think that's a good thing about the movie. I think being exclusionary like that is a bit dickish maneuver, but that's why like hardly anyone is going to enjoy that movie because it was made for like 50,000 people.
The additional movie that I watched that I really enjoyed was the Martin Scorsese
mm-hmm. it was good.
Documentary. Did you guys end up catching that?
Oh, yeah, I love that. But that has more to do with Martin Scorsese as a filmmaker and a director and knowing how to put that film together. But yeah, that was a wonderful film. I really enjoyed that.
That I was making connections between, because I had seen it right after I saw the Mangold movie, and I was really impressed at how much they got right in this latest movie because it was based on the same time period. And so even from that stupid polka dot shirt, I was like, oh, wait. He really did have to wear that stupid shirt. But anyway, I enjoyed it.
Can I say something that I was surprised by?
Yes.
What's that movie? It came out in 1970s. I think it's Rinaldo and Clara.
Yes.
That was written by Bob Dylan. I kind of enjoyed that movie. I don't know why. It's not a great film, but it showed me that if he had stuck with that and kind of worked on his craft a little bit more, he could have been a good screenwriter. Like, it was not bad at all. It was okay. I mean, maybe this is me being a film critic and whatever. I enjoyed it, though. It was interesting. I really enjoyed it.
when he dies, who knows what unfinished projects are going to be unearthed from his basement. Maybe right. There's a whole
oh my God.
Bob Dylan authored TV series down there somewhere.
I would not be surprised.
I had ambitions to watch more of these, like this one, Masked and Anonymous, directed by Larry Charles, written by Bob Dylan and Larry Charles. And I watched the preview of it. I'm like, I don't want to sit through this right now. I don't want to pay to rent it. If it had been free on one of my services, I might have done it. But like, I had enough. And I watched the preview for Hearts of Fire, a 1987 musical drama starring Bob Dylan and a young Rupert Everett as the old rock star coaching a young, very, very 80s woman rock star. I do not ever want to watch this. Maybe if Riff Trax does a... But no, I did not want to live in that place. I was satisfied enough in taking in Al's list of songs and seeing this original movie that, oh, we're doing the early Dylan. This is why he's famous. Everything else is just like, well, he stuck around, but there's no reason, you know, if you just, as I was, introduced to him by the Traveling Wilburys more, his contributions to that album are the worst of anybody. Like, he should not even be on that record. It's a George Harrison, et cetera, project. They were at his house. They were at Bob Dylan's house, so.
He had to do it.
But he tells himself that he was not in a good place. You know, he had sort of run out of, he's a very, you know, mercurial, whimsical guy, and he'll just like run out of steam for years at a time. And then it just depends if he has a really good producer. So he has a really good album from 1988. But then, I don't know, it's hit or miss with the later stuff.
Yeah, and then, but then with he comes out with Time Out of Mind in the 90s, which came out of nowhere and is a surprisingly really good album. But yeah, he's not someone who's had a consistent output throughout his whole life, but that's okay. You know, you revolutionize several genres of music at the same time, you're allowed to have a few off decades.
So the idea of selling out, it seemed like in the film, he was positioned as someone who never wanted to sell out. Whereas, I mean, we all know that he's done commercials. He did a Victoria's Secret ad famously and bizarrely.
I didn't know that.
Oh my God.
I had no idea he did a Victoria's Secret
ad. Go and look it up. It's kind of funny. It's really funny and creepy, too, at the same time.
Did it inspire women to buy more Victoria's Secret?
I don't know. It didn't inspire me. I can tell you that. But anyway, I just thought it was so interesting that here he was, you know, again, you know, you think of like rock stars, in order to stay relevant, you've got to kind of reinvent yourself. But I don't think that applies to him either. He wasn't reinventing himself. He was just kind of going against whatever it was that he did before. Doing something unexpected, and certainly selling out and being in a Victoria's Secret commercial was unexpected.
You are fixated on that. You're fixated on it the Victoria's Secret the weirdest, commercial.
It is so weird. It is just so weird, Lawrence.
Yeah, it's especially jarring given that he sort of created this space for himself, that I'm unique.
Yeah.
And then if he wants to play around in other pop culture areas, he wants to be just on a regular TV show. He wants to be in a regular movie. Like, you're like, ew, that's not right.
Yeah, I know. It's like, what are you doing here?
It's like Picasso showing up.
Let the men experiment. Let the men experiment. He's a true artist. Artists want to do all kinds of weird shit. Look at Kanye West. Just doing weird shit. Let him experiment.
Oh, goodness. He doesn't do a lot of weird shit.
At least he never became anti-Semitic.
Bob Dylan didn't.
No, he didn't. No, I'm talking about Kanye West definitely did.
Robert Zimmerman did not become anti-Semitic. No.
He did become a born-again Christian.
When was that?
So it's the late 70s, and I actually like his songs from that period, late 70s, early 80s.
Really?
Some of them are good. Some of them are less good.
Sure.
It's interesting because there are whole ignorable albums from that kind of era. So yeah, he became a born-again Christian. Didn't he have... I should know this. He had some kind of accident.
Motorcycle accident.
That was quite a bit earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought that was in the 60s when I was doing my research. Yeah.
Knocked him out of touring for 7 years.
Yeah. They point at that in the film, like that he's about to have the motorcycle accident right after the movie ends. It's sort of what's implied. Mm-hmm. that's his destiny.
Yes.
for being such a dick to so many people.
I was going to ask just a... Because we haven't talked much about the songs, so I was just going to ask what your guys' favorites were, if you had a favorite. Because it's really interesting. Like, Mark talks a little bit about being into his love songs and less into the political stuff. And he does have, because Dylan does have several fairly distinct genres that he writes in. And I'm interested to know what you guys are gravitated towards, if anything.
It was kind of thrilling to see those songs played live. And what I loved about this film is that they would play the whole song. They wouldn't just play like a little snippet. They would actually, it almost felt like a long music video or something. It was really fun to see those songs played like that in front of an audience.
The choice of song was really interesting too. I liked that When the Ship Comes In got such a big airing in this movie, which is one of my favorites and you don't see referenced all that much.
Oh, you know what? Mark might hate me for this. I did really enjoy I Shall Be Released. I really enjoyed that song.
Sure.
I love that song.
I like that song.
I thought it was a wonderful song, and I love the message of the song. I did enjoy the song.
He did have a knack for some catchy melodies, for some...
Without a doubt, without a doubt.
Like many songwriters, his melodic imagination was a little bit limited. Like, if you're just singing along with many of his songs, think, could I then add to this, the answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind, that melody... Could you just continue? And there's so many of his songs that actually works very well to do.
Oh, that means so terrible, Mark. Come on, man.
I should clarify, the 1988 album that I was referring to is 1989's Oh Mercy, not 1988's Down in the Groove, which is a piece of garbage for the most part. But Oh Mercy is wonderful. Yeah, I'll recommend. I had the book Chronicles Volume 1 on my shelf, and I was thinking it was just going to be dwelling, you know, it's Volume 1 on his early life, but he actually jumps around to various periods. And one of the periods is the making of this album, and its goodness is a lot to do with the producer, Daniel Lanois, so the same guy that did Peter Gabriel So and the Sling Blade soundtrack and just these atmospheric guitar stuff. That has nothing to do with Dylan's creation. It's just Dylan came in with some songs and was sort of kicked into gear. He requires a producer at this point, or, you know, anytime after the 70s to finish things for him. And so that's what the quality is like. How big a fan is his producer of him? That's going to spruce it all up and make it nice.
Make it nice.
But yeah, Dylan himself recognizes some of those songs as just his shooting star, and most of the time is probably my favorite song of his, maybe. A depressing love song, like as if it was written by a person about themselves. This is what I like about music. Yeah, and because he didn't like that whole voice of your generation, like that's such an impersonal
yeah, it is.
Thing. Like who wants to actually be that? Like there's a...
No.
That means you're not an individual at all. You are merely stating what people want to hear, and nobody's going to be happy with that for more than 5 minutes.
No.
It reminds me of when people were worshiping Eric Clapton and all the stories of how Eric Clapton kind of pushed back against that, didn't like that. Like, no one really enjoys being that kind of figure. It's not fun. It's hard to live up to, and once you get there, it's something you oftentimes want to get away from.
Yeah, there's only one way. But down. you can't stay there forever.
Well, yeah, very much related to one of the main messages of the film is just that fame sort of sucks. If you're a regular person, why would you want... So many films are already about that. I mean, it's not like this was a new thing, but, you know, to show how this explains why he's such an asshole is because, yeah, if you had camera people following you, paparazzi following you around, you're probably going to want to do that as well, unless you're just, as an alternative... Just be gracious and grateful for the attention and use it to say positive things to help the world. That's also something one could do.
So it's why, again, Pete Seeger just provides the contrast in the movie. Mm-hmm. He's the one who uses it for good.
It's also, though, it just seems like it's Bob Dylan's world and we're just living in it. You know, I mean, I can't imagine trying to be his friend or his girlfriend. You know, I mean, just – and Joan Baez, who was – already a superstar, was like, what, you want me just to sit there and watch you write? Like, no, like, get out of my apartment, you know? Even though he's asking for that level of fame because he wants all eyes on him, but at the same time, he obviously doesn't want to be followed around on the street or have people trying to break into his home.
And this, again, is one of the great contradictions of the guy. And we enable it. This is another thing that the movie does a really good job of showing, especially through his relationship with Joan Baez, because, yeah, she doesn't deserve to be treated like that. She calls him out on it, but clearly through the whole movie, she knows that she's going to put up with it because Bob Dylan is larger than life. He's a prophet. He's a great artistic figure. And no one in the movie even says he should be allowed to get away with it because he's a genius. It is just taken for granted. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's one thing that Joan Baez talks about in that Martin Scorsese documentary. She's interviewed, it was 20 years ago when the movie was made, so, but they were showing her then, and she was talking about that time, and it all just seems so present for her even then, even at the beginning of the 21st century, it was still so present for her. And she was like, I mean, what do you do? It's like, I was in love with them, you know, but it was just completely untenable. Like, she could not have the kind of relationship that she needed to have with that man. I don't know who could.
I mean, I'm going to be honest, watching this film and listening to you guys talk about the guy, if he had been a shoe salesman, he'd probably still be an asshole. Like, it just, I don't think it was fame that made him become the man that he became. I just think that he might have been a tough guy to deal with.
Just baked into that personality.
Yeah.
There's an argument that he needed to be that kind of asshole in order to be...
I agree with that. I do agree with that.
Because it's something that you picked up on, Sarah. He sees his artistic role as talking about the world as it is. You don't get, it's not a conversation. Mm-hmm. You're listening. He's telling you things about the world, and your role is to try and understand it if you can. He's not interested in your opinion. And that's not the kind of attitude that a nice person has.
No. He's like, yeah, let's listen to me and try and keep up.
But I am grateful that he had that attitude, because I don't think we would have gotten as much, you know, wonderful music without it. So it's, you know, it's a trade-off. Would I have liked for my sister or whatever to date the guy? Fuck no. But am I happy that he made the music that he did with that kind of attitude? Absolutely.
Yeah, I gotta hope that this is more about being a 20-something-year-old than being who he was.
That. It could be. It definitely could be that. It definitely could be that.
A big part of it. Like, a lot of this is just people in their 20s in New York City getting into messy romantic situations, which is... Dylan is unique in a lot of ways, but not in that way.
All right. I'll encourage people to go to patreon.com/prettymuchpop. At least some of us will discuss a little more. I was just Googling, has Dylan been Me Too'd? And yes, there was a lawsuit, but it was dropped, and so it's unclear. But there's all this stuff in that area I've been thinking about. So, but let's not cloud the main episode with this, since it's not.
You just clouded
it's
it.
It's not part
you
of the story.
You just clouded it. You just did it.
it's these things are inescapable in a certain way, right? You gotta. It's other people in the 60s. Anyway.
I have escaped them successfully. I've definitely not done anything.
For us as news readers, as contemplators of the scene and the behavior of people 30, 40 years ago. All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Let us know what you thought of the episode, what you thought of the movie. We'd love to hear from you. Mark at prettymuchpop.com. That at least works. I'll forward your feedback to everybody else. I think I turned comments off on the website because it was just so much spam. But there's also a contact form through the Partially Examined Life site. And there are ways to reach us, especially through Patreon. You can message us immediately. You can let us know your every little thought. So,
would love to hear your thoughts.
Yes.
Would love to hear them.
All right. So long, everybody.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Bye, guys.
Pretty Much Pop is part of the Partially Examined Life podcast network. Get more Pretty Much Pop at prettymuchpop.com. Get bonus content for every episode at patreon.com/prettymuchpop.